Hey guys, it's Mina. Before we get to the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny, which is presented by DraftKings, America's top-rated daily fantasy app, wanted to remind you to check out KJZ on ESPN Radio weekdays from 6 to 10 a.m. Eastern with former Super Bowl champion Keyshawn Johnson, you can see on NFL Live, former National Player of the Year and number two overall pick in the NBA draft, Jay Williams, and acclaimed SportsCenter host Zubin Mehenti. If you miss the show live, you can listen anytime as a podcast wherever you get your pods. Welcome back to the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny, the only NFL podcast where one of the hosts is really hoping that the Puppy Bowl accepts remote competitors this year. That's me. No, that would be Lenny. I'm Mina Kimes. And coming off of a, I would say, you know what? It lived up to its billing, championship weekend. It wasn't underwhelming. It wasn't overwhelming. It was just whelming. I'm delighted to be joined by a guest. Our producer, Dan, said you had been on, I can't remember because it's been so long, but it's Shiel Kapadia, NFL writer at The Athletic. You can catch him on The Athletic football show. Shiel, when was the last time you were on my podcast?
I don't know. It's been too long. You know, I've been waiting for the call. I've been checking my emails, my texts, my DMs. Nothing's coming in, but you know, it's good to finally be back.
Well, the last time I remember seeing you, at least, was in Seattle when we did the Bill Barnwell live podcast when Nemos presented me with a DVOA jersey. Lots changed in Seattle now. The Seahawks are no longer the upper echelon, my guests have taught me how to say echelon, of DVOA. And, you know, you no longer cover the team. And it just feels like a totally different NFL landscape these days.
It is. And I'm excited. I think it's going to be a wild offseason. Like I'm starting to become one of those people who likes the offseason as much as or more than the actual season. Like I'm excited for the next 3-4 months. What about you? If they told you like, hey, you can only do your podcast either during the season or in the offseason, like that was in your contract with ESPN, what would you choose?
Well, it's so varied because some off seasons, like last off season was because aside from Brady, so Brady signed early on and the Stafford thing, or pardon me, Philip Rivers thing happened pretty quickly, but otherwise it was like pretty quiet. This offseason feels like it could be a lot crazier. And I kind of jumped the gun a little bit saying Matt Stafford's name, because that's of course the biggest shoe to drop. And it sounds like, based on what my colleague Adam Schefter is saying, that shoe is going to drop pretty quickly. I guess shoe is the wrong analogy. It's more like dominoes than shoes because there's only two shoes and you can't like not multiple shoes can't drop. But the first domino to fall, I think, will be Matt Stafford. But then you're like looking at a number of possible free agent quarterbacks, trades, teams that need quarterbacks with high draft picks, teams that are sounding ambivalent about their quarterbacks, like the Rams, of course, the Niners. Like it's absolute craziness, Shiel. And that's what I want to talk about first. So having you on today to recap the championship games with an eye towards the Super Bowl. But before we get to that, I want to talk about the upcoming quarterback carousel. And I want to talk about that first shoe/domino, Matthew Stafford. I guess let's start here. How good do you think Matthew Stafford is? Because I think that's an important basis for this conversation as we think to which team should make a run at him.
I think the quarterback like landscape in the league right now is very interesting because you have sort of the elite, right? If you can get anybody, a Patrick Mahomes, a Deshaun Watson, whatever, we can name 3, 4, however many quarterbacks you think, then that's always the goal. The guy who basically, I know this doesn't fit for Watson this last year, but basically you're going to be in the mix for a playoff spot. Like if you have that guy, he can lift everyone around him. But I feel like the second tier goes from like the number 6 quarterback to like the number 23 quarterback. And I would put Stafford in that sort of big second tier. And I think among those guys, you have to weigh a lot of different options. I mean, one is how much do you want to spend for them? And then two is what is their ceiling? Because there could be guys in that second tier. And I think Stafford probably falls in this group that if you look at it, I would probably say he's I don't know, maybe around like the 10th or 12th best quarterback in the league, but in the right circumstance, whether it's scheme, supporting cast, offensive line, whatever, that guy can be a top five guy and you can have one of the most efficient offenses in the league. So that's kind of how I look at Stafford right now in that group.
Yeah, I think he's, because I was asked about this recently and I gave the same kind of wishy-washy answer as you, where I was like, well, it depends on the context. But, you know, he's 5 to 15 for me in that range, which, you know, that's valuable in this league to guarantee that you're going to have at least an above average quarterback with the ceiling of being in that even top 10. And then to get him as the acquiring team would in a trade on a relatively cheap contract, right? In the low 20s. Now they're going to have to probably extend him after a year. So you have to take that into consideration. But in that first year, he's not costing you a lot of money. It's basically Teddy Bridgewater money for a quarterback who, as we just said, puts you, you can compete for a Super Bowl with Matthew Stafford if you have the right roster, in my opinion. So then you look to the teams that are sort of being rumored to be in contention. It feels like everybody's earmarked him for Indianapolis, and you see why. Like, he just looks like a Colt. He just feels like a Colt. Like, it's so easy to imagine him in a Colts jersey. But also, that's a team. One, Philip Rivers is retiring. I feel like I haven't really paid him due. I will at some point this offseason. My love for him is well documented. But it's a team that was, you know, has a very good defense, good pieces, great offensive line, quarterback away. They're picking 21st. They have $68 million in cap space, have some young players. It makes sense. But Chiel, just because it's a good destination for Stafford doesn't mean that Detroit isn't picking up the phone when Washington, New England, Denver, San Francisco is picking very high and would also be attractive for Stafford. When any of those teams call, like, do you think any of them are more likely destinations based on like the capital they have to give up and also whether they'd be attractive to Stafford than Indianapolis?
Yeah, the Colts are the team that, like, they have to 100% find a starting quarterback somewhere. So every conversation, whether it's Darnold or Wentz or Stafford or, you know, any quarterback that comes up, it's like, oh, the Colts, they like literally don't have a quarterback other than Jacob Eason on their roster. And then there are all these other teams, you know, maybe like 10 teams you were just mentioning where it's sort of like, well, they kind of have somebody, but they could look to upgrade, that kind of thing. And so the team that comes to mind is just sort of my favorite fit, maybe on both sides, is San Francisco.
Gross. Sorry, keep going. It's good. I'm sorry. I'm just being a salty Seahawks fan. Keep talking. Sorry.
Because, you know, if you're Matthew Stafford, you look at the different types of schemes. I know, you know, I think some people like the Colts scheme and sort of the talent there a little bit more than I do. I thought it was fine. I thought, you know, they're a playoff team, but I wasn't wowed by it. But man, if you're Matthew Stafford and you look at it and you say, Jimmy Garoppolo got to a Super Bowl with this team, they've since added Brandon Ayuk. If they can bring Trent Williams back, like, the team could be very, very good and an instant contender right away. And I feel like you go there and you just know that the coach is going to maximize your talent and maximize your chances of being really good. You know, the Matt Ryan MVP season comes up all the time with the Falcons. Like, that, you know, if Matthew Stafford went to the Niners, it would not shock me to see him have a season like that, because, you know, in that scheme, when you have the talent that Matthew Stafford has, I just think that would be really appealing for him. And also, if you're San Francisco, you're already, you know, you can either pay Garoppolo what you're paying him in the mid-20s. You actually save money. You would save, I think, around $4 million by acquiring Stafford. And of course, you have to trade away a first-round pick. But to me, that would be a home run for both sides.
Yeah, the Matt Ryan season, I'd written that down as well, because we haven't seen Kyle Shanahan with a quarterback like that since then, right? And it calls to mind, I'm not making this comparison, but often we see these Shanahan tree offenses with quarterbacks who, you know, it's kind of the chicken or the egg. It's not, is this scheme making the quarterback or vice versa? Can he elevate it, the scheme? And then you see like Aaron Rodgers in Green Bay this year, where you have that offense and then suddenly you have a quarterback who's really good. And I'm not saying Matthew Stafford is Aaron Rodgers. I think Matt Ryan is a much better comparison. But to inject a quarterback who can use the entire like who can make every throw into that offense where suddenly you're not primarily just throwing it into, you know, that 20-yard space in the middle of the field. Suddenly it becomes a lot more terrifying and interesting, frankly. That's a really good football team with him. It's scary, you know. They've got some free agents. They're going to lose some guys. They got to pay Fred Warner this year. But shoot, I mean, and golly, I think probably become favorites in the NFC West with Stafford. Now in the competition, you know, they have the 12th overall pick. Indy's picking 21st. I think if I'm San Francisco, I part with that pick for Stafford. I part with 9 if I'm Denver, Chiel. Like I wouldn't be too precious with these draft picks.
Yeah, Denver is an interesting one because I think they have sort of a sneaky, interesting roster, you know, like defensively, you know, Fangio is going to get, he's going to maximize whatever talent they have. I think his scheme right now is like the best scheme in the NFL where, you know, even if they can withstand some injuries. And if you actually upgrade the talent, their defense could be really good. I thought they were going to be really good coming into the season. They have young wide receivers. I mean, if Cortland Sutton comes back healthy and now you have Judy and Hamler, that's one when you mentioned like being able to see Stafford in a Colts uniform, I can kind of see him in a Broncos uniform.
Totally.
You know? Maybe they do the throwbacks and the orange and blue. And I feel like if Elway were still in charge, I'm afraid to think of how many draft picks they might give up because I feel like Stafford would be exactly his type. So I definitely think that's a good name. Can I throw you my craziest Stafford idea out there?
Please.
What if you're the Dallas Cowboys and you're having these conversations with Dak Prescott for, it feels like, you know, the 19th straight year. I know it hasn't been that long and you just can't come to terms on an agreement. And you're thinking, what are we going to do here? Are we going to pay him $37 million on the franchise tag next year and then not know what our future holds in 2022 and beyond? Or could we, and this is, this is some outside the box thinking, and I might get something wrong, so please correct me. Or do we trade for Matthew Stafford? We have a very good offense. We could definitely be competing in the NFC right away. We're paying him $21.5 million per year over the next 2 seasons. We can tag Prescott and trade him. So now, like, if you're giving up a first, you can very much get a first back for Dak Prescott. And you have 2 years and you can actually add to your roster with a little bit more cap space. Well, am I crazy or is this a fun outside the box idea?
The tag and trade makes it really interesting because I do think with Stafford, we are talking so much about the cheap, you know, the fact that it's only 21.5, right? So, you know, there's 2 years left on his deal. So realistically, whatever team acquires him is also, if he plays well, going to have to extend him at whatever price Dak Prescott is making. Would you agree with that? Like, let's say Dak commands $40 million-ish, I don't know, whatever quarterbacks are making in 2022. Matthew Stafford is going to get paid that as well in probably a year. But, you know, to be able to get Matt Stafford, have the cheap year, and get a return for Prescott, that is, it's alluring. You know, the team in the NFC East that I thought made a lot of sense, I alluded to this, was Washington. Like, I like that from Stafford's point of view. Am I crazy? Like, that's an elite defense. Maybe elite's a little strong. Very good defense. They've got, I think, a number one in Terry McLaurin. Great running game. Antonio Gibson. Good coaching staff. They've got, you know, they're picking ahead of Indy. And you get to play in the NFC East. I'd rather play in the NFC East than like New England and the AFC East and play, you know, with Buffalo. Agree or disagree?
Yeah, no, I think they're a big wild card, I think, with all these quarterbacks because of everything you just said. I mean, obviously they need someone and you absolutely can envision a scenario where they upgrade at quarterback and they're a playoff team next year. By the way, I would draft Terry McLaurin like unspeakably high in all of my fantasy drafts. Yeah,
so
if he got a quarterback, me too. Like, please just get, you know, there's always like that one wide receiver where you're like, please just get this guy a quarterback so we can actually see what they're capable of. So now with that, I would say like, I do like their defense, the defensive line, you know, you're young, all those guys are coming back. So you would think they have a high floor, but As you've talked about, as we know, there's more variance with defense year to year. So it's like, all right, they're probably going to be pretty good. I don't know if they're going to be a top five unit. And their offense, it still needs a lot of work. You know, I love McLaurin. You have to decide what you're going to do with Brandon Scherff and the offensive line. You need more weapons, but I don't think that's a bad thought. I mean, if you're Washington, you're sort of in this weird spot. You know, do you just target a young quarterback and say, all right, we're going to take our time and groom this guy? Or do you say, we just made the playoffs last year. The division isn't great. If we get Matthew Stafford and like sign a wide receiver, then all of a sudden we're really interesting. So yeah, I think they're a name that absolutely should be mentioned for him.
And they've got cap space, draft picks. They've got the 2 third rounders. I mean, look, this team almost beat Tampa with Taylor Heinicke.
Yeah.
Right. Like that happened. It feels like a fever dream, the Heinicke moment, but it was real. I lived it. The Heinicke Hive was short-lived. So I don't know. There's a lot of interesting teams in the mix. And so this is going to, you know, this is going to happen. And then I think it'll set off kind of a chain reaction in the NFL, because if it's, say, Indy, then suddenly we look at Sam Darnold as an option. A lot of people seem to think the Jets stick by him and do something with the number two, either take quarterback or trade down. I don't even really enjoy talking about the Deshaun Watson thing, because because of the no trade clause, he's not going anywhere unless he wants to. And by all accounts, he wants Miami, which, by the way, that team would be fire. But so I don't want to do the whole guessing game. Like, well, how about Deshaun Watson on the Bears? Like, no, like Deshaun Watson is going to go where Deshaun Watson wants to go. I think Dak Prescott stays in Dallas, frankly. So I don't like, I like your idea, but beyond that, it doesn't really feel open to speculation. And then, you know, the shield is not like the free agent market gets a lot less attractive. You're talking about, you know, your Cam Newtons, your Jameis's, your Ryan Fitzpatrick's, and you know,
The dominoes, like when you were mentioning the dominoes, I was like, well, should we start with Watson? But you make a good point. It's sort of like, I still don't know how seriously to take it. Like, cause then the first domino might be, who are the Texans going to hire as right. their head coach? And then how's that going to affect him? And then where does he want to go? Where is he comfortable going? And then if it is Miami, do they trade to you? Like, there are so many wild things that can happen. Even in my scenario, like I was just like, I'm going to take this, this crazy Cowboys Stafford thing to the next level. Like couldn't the Colts, wouldn't Dak Prescott make sense for a team like the Colts? You know, a young quarterback whom Frank Reich can have him in his system. They can sign him to a long-term extension. They've been going year by year for the last 3 years. Yeah. They can finally have some stability and not have to worry about it. So there are all these moving parts where, I don't like to hype it up and say this is going to be like the wildest offseason since we've been alive. But it does feel like the quarterback stuff is going to be crazy. And I think a lot of it is what we talked about, is that there are a bunch of guys who different coaches, GMs will evaluate them differently and say, hey, if we got this guy in our scheme with our weapons right. and our play caller, you know, he could be really good. And another team might say that about a different quarterback. And so even like the compensation parts about these trades or even these contracts are going to be fun to watch.
And that's so important too, because like if a team like Indy goes off the board, like let's say in this game of musical chairs, that's where Matt Stafford ends up sitting. That's a seat that I think a lot of people thought if Philadelphia was to trade Wentz, it was like, okay, well, Frank Reich, that's the guy, right? That makes sense. But suddenly that's out of the picture. And then you start thinking, well, would a trade happen? What do the new coaches think? We don't know. I mean, that with the Jets, for example, it's so hard for me to speculate as to what they'll do at quarterback, because I don't know what everyone in that building now, Robert Saleh and Mike LaFleur, pardon me, what they think of Sam Darnold. I think my preference would be for them to move on and start fresh with a new quarterback. But I don't know if that's what, you know, they might like Darnold, and then they might think, okay, we'll take Penei Sewell, or we'll trade down and build around him. But ultimately there's more teams that need quarterbacks than there are Staffords, Prescotts, Watsons, the big three. I mean, you're looking at, like we mentioned, Denver. I think they should do something. Washington absolutely needs to do something. New England, Pittsburgh, New Orleans, possibly Carolina, Chicago? Did I leave any teams out that are obviously that need to do something?
If we assume, I guess, that the Saints are going to stay put, but who knows? You know, they don't have a lot of room to work with. The Panthers, you know, are they tied to Teddy Bridgewater? And so, yeah, it's kind of all these different options. I mean, if you trade for Watson, obviously it's a home run, but even like the Darnold aspect of this is very interesting to me, because that's somebody for some of these teams that don't have a lot to spend, you know, like the Rams, like would Sean McVay look at it and say, let's go get Sam Darnold. Let's at least get some competition in here. And if he plays well, then we can figure it out after this season. Or a team like the Steelers, if Ben Roethlisberger retires, do they look at it? Do those teams look at a guy like Cam Newton and say, no one is paying him big money? He was in a terrible situation last year. Maybe there is more to work with than his numbers indicate. So there's like the top tier, there's a middle tier, and there's that tier where if you're really, you know, strapped for cap space or cash or whatever, and you want an option, like there still are some options out there where you could make a move.
Yeah, I think that's really important to note that when we talk about, it's not just about the different tiers of quarterbacks, it's also the different tiers of teams in terms of what they can afford and how much maneuverability they have. I mean, you're talking, you know, about the Saints have negative $300 million, pardon me, was the joke I was trying to make. It's really 90, actually, which like you don't even really need to make a joke, just say the number. So they can't do anything. They might, but we assume they want some competition, right? Or the Rams, I think, will also fall into that bucket. The language coming out of Los Angeles about Jared Goff is not good. Which
they're just being mean at this point, aren't they? Like, my gosh, come on, the guy. I mean, I'm not the biggest Jared Goff fan, but the guy, you know, you paid him. He took you to a Super Bowl.
It's crazy.
My feelings would be hurt. Yeah,
he wasn't even that bad in the last game. Is the funniest part,
right?
But you know, they're not wrong to sort of be dissatisfied with the season. However, and this is a great case study in contracts between them and their division mate, San Francisco. Those are two very different quarterback contracts. And here's where you see the consequences, because San Francisco can absolutely easily move on from Jimmy and the Rams can't. So if they're even to bring in competition, it would have to be some like a draft pick or them letting Wolford compete or someone really cheap, like a Winston or, a Newton or whatever. So a lot of chips left chips fall too. I did shoes, dominoes. What else? What other metaphor is
fall. Yeah, that's right.
Chips fall. Yeah. I don't know. It's about to get crazy. So to bring it all back to your question, Chill, I am delighted to be podcasting this offseason. Not every offseason, but this one's going to be a fascinating one, beginning with Stafford. But let's take a break and then let's actually talk about some football.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We all go through things socially where we don't feel like ourselves, where we don't feel like going out, where we feel drained, or we're not bursting with energy. And when you're not feeling right, that's where BetterHelp can come in. It's helpful for learning positive coping skills, how to set boundaries in so many different ways, for which it empowers you to be the best version of yourself. It isn't just for those who experience major trauma. Therapy is for more than those people, and it's there to help you. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. It's there for you. It's there to help you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/MinaShow, MinaShow, today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/MinaShow.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now, get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th, one-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
So, Sheila, I was trying to make a case for Chiefs Bills to be close, or rather to Bills to pull off the upset, right? Like last week and all week, yeah. My case sort of depended on Patrick Mahomes being 80% or less and having a lack of mobility. 2 minutes into the game, like the craziest thing is like he wasn't 100%, but I feel like 2 minutes into the game or whenever their first drive was, I can't remember. I said to myself, yeah, all right, well, that's out the window because he was moving absolutely fine. In fact, they were like booting him out and stuff on the first drive. What did you make of Mahomes? Like obviously his performance is excellent, but how he looked generally in terms of his health and how unstoppable on a scale of one through Andy Reid's mask looking like a jockstrap, would you say this offense is right now?
I don't even know where to go on that scale, Mina. So I will just say what I think about Patrick Mahomes. I mean, I thought that was him at the peak of his powers. You know, every sort of tool that he has was on display. And I was with you. I really thought that, you know, I picked the Bills. I thought they were going to pull I thought they had a chance to pull the upset. You know, it's not necessarily fun to pick the favorite all the time, but I really thought they had a chance and they just couldn't stop him. And it was in so many different ways. Like you mentioned, there was the athleticism was crazy. I thought, you know, even if he's 85, 90%, I didn't think it was going to look like that. There was that stretch, I think it was in the second quarter where the Bills, I think, brought a pressure and Matt Milano,
oh my God,
like by the waist. I watched this play like eight times today in slow motion. And the funniest thing is like Patrick Mahomes releases the ball with Milano on his waist, gets spun around as a 360. By the time he sees whether it was caught or not, he's done a 360. And it was a huge play in the game. I mean, I think it was a 14-9 game, I want to say, at that point. That was a third down where if he doesn't make that play, the Bills get the ball back. And then I think it was the very next play, AJ Epenesa, you know, gets right after him on play action. He avoids the sack and he finds Tyreek Hill for a 33-yard gain. So physically he was ridiculous. Mentally, I mean, he just had a beat on what the Bills were doing, whether it was their different blitz looks, them trying to disguise coverages, whatever. It was just like everything he does at such an elite level was on full display.
The craziest part of all is I do think his foot was bothering him. Like as much as I thought, wow, he's moving in the pocket really well. He's dodging free rushers like crazy, you know, and as I mentioned, they actually had him booting out here and there. He still looked a little uncomfortable at times, but his arm is so stupid. It doesn't matter. Like the fact that he can make literally any throw on earth from any platform at any angle, it just subverts the physics of quarterbacking. So even if he's falling down, he can still hit Travis Kelce. The two plays you mentioned with Milano and Epenesa, my colleague Dan Orlowski was like, that should have been like negative 30 yards.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. And it's so dispiriting as a defense because frankly, I thought the Bills, like they played him the right way. Like in the first half, they basically did the same thing they did the first time around. They didn't blitz a lot. They played a lot of soft zone, trying to limit the Chiefs vertically. And Mahomes took what was available to him. You know, he was throwing the ball. He was getting it out really quickly. I think I have his air yards or his average depth of target. It was pretty low in this game. But the problem is the Chiefs have so much speed, and also he places the ball so perfectly that a 10-yard ball becomes 15, 20, 70 in the case of Tyreek Hill in an instant. And 5.7 yards was his average depth of target, which is obviously way lower than Mahomes' average. He also was getting the ball out quicker than any quarterback this weekend. But it doesn't matter, you know? It just doesn't matter because of all the speed they have in that offense. I think if there's any, you know, before Bucks fans walk off a cliff right now, something you're going to hear a lot in the coming weeks is losing Eric Fisher, their left tackle, and then they're going to have to do the Jenga it's not really Jenga, when you move guys around again on the offensive line. That we're going to talk about what the Bucs defense did to Green Bay. That's concerning for sure. But other than that, other than the fact that they lost Eric Fisher, I can't point to a single negative from what I saw. out of Kansas City.
Yeah, and the numbers back that up. I was looking up at looking up just their sort of EPA offensively for the season to see where that game ranked, and it was their best offensive performance of the entire season. And then I looked at the last 2 years because I was like, well, they keep doing this to teams in the playoffs. Their top three performances of the last 2 years have all been playoff games. So it's like, you know, there were times in the second half of the season where I think people were having that conversation. Are the Chiefs not as good? Is Andy Reid just not pulling out all the tricks because he doesn't need to? And so, like, I don't know that that's the case, but you can, if you look at all their playoff performances from the last 2 years, they're all above even the Chiefs standards, above average for the Chiefs standards. And so, like, I think they do. I don't know if they save stuff. I mean, it would be interesting to hear Andy Reid talk about that, or if they just rise to the occasion and Patrick Mahomes is in full command. And the other thing that he does is, like, all the stuff Andy Reid used to get made fun of, you know, like the clock management and timeouts, like Mahomes has sort of taken care of that for Reid. You know, if you notice, like, them in a 2 minute drill, or it's a situation where do they have to call timeout or not? Like, he's just like, I've got this, you know, he doesn't like look, he doesn't need to look at the sideline. He's just like, don't screw me up. I think it was a play last year where, like, Reid called timeout or something, and he didn't think it was the right move. And he was just like, what are you doing? You know, I've got this. And I feel like since then, they're just like, all right, you know, Patrick Mahomes has this. We don't need to even worry about it. So, when you're playing them, I don't want to say that they're totally unstoppable and you have no chance, because what, they went 8 straight weeks without winning by more than 6 points. So teams were competitive. But I think that version that we saw in the AFC Championship game, I think that specific version is basically unstoppable.
I guess it is. It reminds me a little bit, if I had to say, like, I don't think they were messing around for, you know, the entire regular season and hiding all their good plays, but watching them, it felt a little bit like watching LeBron in the playoffs, where all of a sudden, like, he turns it up to 100. And I feel like that watching Mahomes, not that he's not necessarily not trying during the regular season, but there was it was a play. You talked about how good he was against the blitz, and the Bills didn't blitz a lot. Obviously, later in the game, they got frustrated and just started trying stuff, playing a little bit more man and blitzing, just because, you know, what can you do at that point? But I remember it was the touchdown to Kelsey where they blitzed him, and Kelsey, it's leaks out, right? And Mahomes, they got to him, they brought him down, but he held on to it just long enough for the pressure to get there, Kelsey to leak, and for him to get the ball off. And that's, like, watching him, I was like, that's playoff Mahomes. Like, he's going to take the hit. He's going to wait until the last second. He's going to do whatever it takes in this scenario. And I kind of felt like that. I've felt like that generally watching the Chiefs offense over the last couple of weeks. Not necessarily, again, that it was shenanigans, just that suddenly everything's turned up to 100. I think the Bills' best chance in this game was not to deviate from the plan or to stop them on defense. It was to keep up. And I think that, for me as a Bills fan, that's probably the more disappointing side of this, is seeing the offense look pretty much like their 2019 self. Is that fair?
I totally agree. I mean, you know, if they would have lost this game like 41-31 or something like that, but the offense was playing well, then I think you can say, you know what, Patrick Mahomes make, you know, and Andy Reid, they make people look stupid all the time. No big deal. But if I'm a Bills fans, I mean, I think there's a couple things that would trouble me. And the first one is what you just said, the offense. I mean, one touchdown on your first 8 possessions, and that came off a muffed punt. Like, you have no chance. I mean, you really have no chance against the Chiefs if you do that. And it wasn't just one game. I mean, if you look at their 3-game sample here in the playoffs and just look at, like, the, you know, EPA and the advanced stats, it kind of translates to like the 16th best offense in the NFL. And so it wasn't the offense that we all watched in, you know, the last 11, 12, 13 weeks, where I watched it at times and thought, they're a juggernaut. Like, they really have an opportunity to come out of the AFC and make it to the Super Bowl. And I think they were rattled. You know, there were times where, you know, Singletary drops that ball. Josh Allen's accuracy was not very good. They had protection issues. And the blitz thing you mentioned, it really stands out in comparison to how the Bills handled the blitz, because Mahomes knew what was coming. His internal clock was great. He knew how to avoid the pressure and buy a second. And Josh Allen and the Bills off offense. It felt like they were just confused all game long when the Chiefs were sending all these different looks their way. So, you know, it's tough because you don't want to be like, all right, you know, the previous 10, 11 weeks didn't matter. These three games, the offense didn't look good. I'm sure it's somewhere in between. But I think if you're the Bills, you do have to look at it and say, what happened to us in the playoffs where we certainly were not playing our best in those three games?
Well, it was interesting because I'm sure you did the same thing I did, which is I went back and watched game one, right? And thought, okay, how is this going to be different this time around? And I said, well, I figured the Bills defense will probably play Mahomes pretty similarly. And they did. I did not. So in the first game, the Chiefs defense blitzed the hell out of Josh Allen and played a lot of man, did the things that they do. And since then, between week six when they played, I think it was week six, and the playoffs, Mahomes became this man-beating, blitz-beating Terminator. So I thought, okay, you know, I don't know if they're going to play it fast and loose or be as aggressive against Allen. And did I say Allen? Allen's a Terminator. So, but they're both man-beating Terminators. But in any case, I was actually kind of surprised. The Chiefs came out with a pretty similar plan. You know, I'd say there are some variations in terms of the use of disguise and how they use the honey badger, but they certainly didn't sit back and give Allen the same treatment that Mahomes got. And shoot, it worked. I mean, he just looked like his weeks the same way he did in week six. I mean, he averaged negative 0.13 expected points added per attempt against man defense. Josh Allen's statistics against man defense this year are insane. Outside of these two games, the Chiefs played a ton of cover zero and cover one. And some of it, I think you can attribute to Allen looked confused by the looks they were showing in pre and post snap. But the Chiefs secondary just like were as sticky as hell. That's gross, Mina. But they were. I mean, and it's not just Matthew. Like, I said this on live, like Juan Thornhill, who the hell yes. was this guy? I mean, I know he is, but all season coming back from the injury, he kind of stunk. Okay. And I don't like saying that. He was not his old self. I liked him so much as a rookie. And then he was the best player on the field half the time. I mean, holy smokes. And so like, as much as we talk about Chris Jones and Frank Clark, I thought the Chiefs secondary was incredible in this game.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thornhill just, you know, preparing for this podcast was like the first guy I wrote down for the Chiefs defense. He was incredible. I mean, he was everywhere. And I think just the way they use their safeties and just the different things that Spagnuolo does, like you can't get a handle on it. You know, they played cover, you know, you mentioned cover zero, cover one, they did that. And then there are snaps where they're just sitting back in cover two and the safeties are really deep. And then there are other snaps where it looks like the safeties are going to be deep and there's like a crosser and they just fire downhill and all of a sudden Allen is holding on to the ball. And so they schemed up things like they're willing to do everything. They had that the one slot blitz where Legarius Sneed got him. They had Derek Nnadi, 312 pounds, is dropping into coverage, where I'm always like, you know, when a defensive coordinator does it, I'm like, dude, come on, you know, you're trying to get cute and like show off here. But, you know, it worked there. They certainly confused Allen and got to him with the sack. And they did a great job. I think Allen, like when he's beating the blitz, and you were right, I mean, he was crushing blitz. He was crushing man coverage. A lot of times he would, even if there was a free rusher, he would make that guy miss and then do something. But Legarius Sneed, Tyrann Mathieu, you know, he caused that intentional grounding. Like they were there, they got there and they finished. They ended the play. It wasn't like they were just going to get fooled by a pump fake and let him buy time. You know, Bashaud Breeland, right, causes the interception. So their defensive backs definitely played well. And I was just really impressed by their game plan, how aggressive they were willing to be at times, how much they mixed things up. You could tell they just kind of won that matchup. Whether it's Spagnuolo against Daboll or however you want to term it, they won that matchup for sure.
Yeah, it's because this Super Bowl is a sneaky great defensive coordinator matchup. We're going to talk about Bucks in a second, but Bowles versus Spags, man. I mean, the old dudes, you know? How about it? I mean, they're not that old, but they're not like the hot young kids on the block, you know, coaching candidate types, but they just in a game plan basis, both were incredibly good this weekend, I thought. And yeah, so let's wrap before this game by talking about the Bills, because we're going to talk about the Chiefs next week, obviously, and in that game and that matchup. So like, look, you're coming off of this incredibly successful season. You get to keep your offensive coordinator, which nobody thought would happen. But it's this disappointing end where Josh Allen sort of reverts in some ways to, you know, the prior season version of himself, I guess. What do you think, Buffalo? Do you think there's anything they need to do or anything they need to change going forward? I will add, by the way, they're keeping Daboll. They might not keep Leslie Frazier, who is apparently a hot candidate in Houston. But putting a pin in that, like, Buffalo season, undeniably a success. What is your on your offseason to-do list for them?
Yeah, I think they figured out the hard part, and you know, you would hope that carries over, where they did have a top five offense for the entire season, and I love the way they built it, and they have so many weapons. So I think they need to figure out the offensive line. They've got a couple offensive linemen who are free agents. They've got to figure that out. Defensively, you know, I think they can definitely add some talent up front with their pass rush, where on those plays where they're not going to be blitzing a lot, or those games where they're not going to be blitzing a lot, they can get home. And then I think McDermott, you know, definitely has to look at his approach in this game. That to me was one of the most disappointing aspects of the loss for them, because they've been really good with in-game management and being aggressive and that type of thing. And then you get in a big spot like this and you're kicking the field goal early on fourth and three, which that one I can sort of understand. But man, when they kicked that field goal on fourth and goal from the two before halftime, I think everyone was like, this game's over. Like, we've been watching. Mahomes has been carving you guys up. And so, you know, I think foundationally they are sort of analytically sound, and I know they listen to some of that stuff. And like I said, their decision-making was good for a while, but they've got to revisit why they sort of reverted or got conservative in that spot. But for personnel wise, I think mostly it's kind of the front seven on defense, but I think they should still have a very good team next year.
So I'm trying not to be a parody of myself and complain about the field goals too much, because I've already done enough of that. But, you know, I tweeted this, the McDermott field goals were worse than the LaFleur one, which at least was defensible. I don't think the McDermott ones were defensible at all. And he said today something about boosting morale, going into halftime, getting points. You know what boosts morale? Touchdowns, okay? And not losing to Patrick Mahomes. It is funny, Sheil, like, this is a larger conversation, how all these young coaches just are turtling up in the playoffs. Vrabel, McDermott, I guess LaFleur to some degree. Then you got these old dudes like Reed and Arians who just are, they have no Fs to give anymore, I guess. That's it. I don't know. It's weird. It's a bummer, man, though. Like, that, I too was bummed by that. I want to say one thing about the Bills offseason, though. The other thing McDermott said, I think it was him, maybe it was Daboll, I think it was, or Bean, or I don't know, somebody in the organization said, we need to improve our running game. And of course, this instigated round 3,456 of running back value, whatever, on Twitter. But they do need to improve their run game. And I thought that really jumped out in this game in particular, but throughout the postseason. Improving your run game doesn't mean, you know, pounding the rock on first down. It means having an efficient rushing attack. And the Bills just didn't. And I think it really hurt them, especially when you saw this kind of jumpiness from Josh Allen and the ability of the Chiefs, you know, to have a ton of success getting pressure on obvious passing downs and early downs as well. So I think that is something they need to fix, because I think losing Zach Moss was a sneaky, impactful injury. And I don't know, Singletary has been sort of underwhelming there. So that would put that on the to-do list.
Yeah, I feel like they can't figure out what they want to do with the run game, because they have this quarterback who you absolutely could have a quarterback inclusive run game, but he's
that
not
as well.
Like,
yeah.
He's not like, you know, Lamar Jackson or Kyler Murray, where they're really smart and they get down and they, you know, they protect themselves and they don't fumble. Like, when he gets going, it's like, all right, you know, anything can happen right now. So I think they have to decide whether they want him to be a part of that, like in the regular season or just in high leverage situations, or what they want to do, and then sort of shape it from there.
They also need to tell him, stop running backwards. Josh, backwards is not the way you want to go. The super sacks. I mean,
yeah.
Josh Allen, incredible season, unprecedented improvement. I have taken many L's, but the sacks, like the crazy 25-yard sacks. Even the ref and the one before the fight broke out, which like we have so much to talk about, we can't even break down, even though it's like hilarious to me. The ref was like, maybe it was the umpire. He was just like, whoa, you were not supposed to be back here. I was just chilling. I thought the game was over. So anyways, stop taking super sacks. All right. And I promise to never say the word super sacks again. When we come back, we're going to talk about the other championship game, which was, I think, a little bit more exciting, and some takeaways from that. Stephen A. Smith goes beyond the headlines to unlock a unique world of hot takes, one-of-a-kind segments, and can't-miss interviews. Stream all of this and more on his new show, Stephen A.'s World, exclusively on ESPN+. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com. Chill, since we already touched on this, I might as well start here with you. On a scale of 1 through Andy Reid's face shield, how angry are you at Matt LaFleur for kicking the field goal at the end? And how mad should people be?
I think they should be very upset. I was very upset. I did not even think it was a possibility. And what I think is sort of the most interesting part of this conversation, well, two things I would say. One is that the Packers were the most aggressive team on fourth down the entire season. And so the game's on the line, the season's on the line. You have an MVP quarterback, an all-pro wide receiver, the most efficient offense in the NFL. And that's the time where you choose to not be who you've been all year and get conservative and kick the field goal. So that was like my initial watching it reaction to it. But a couple of days later, though, what I'm thinking, you know, I think you've probably looked at all these models, right? Mm-hmm. With the win probabilities, and a lot of them say it was pretty close, and you know, it wasn't a no-brainer. But talking to some people, you know, who are smarter than me, they've said don't necessarily in that spot just look at the change in win probability, because in that spot there's 2 minutes left, and so you're not going to have an opportunity to grab like a big chunk of win probability later. It's not like it's happening in the second quarter. And so basically what they said is all you want to look in at that spot is what gives you the biggest upside. And so if you look at like Ben Baldwin, you know, his fourth down bot on Twitter, if you score the touchdown there, the win probability swings to 24%. Whereas if you kick the field goal, it swings to 9%. Now, are you more likely to make the field goal than the touchdown? Yeah, of course. But like that doesn't matter at that point. You've got to like do whatever you can to maximize your chances of winning the game. I mean, that discrepancy in win probability should not be as important as just what gives you the most upside. And so in that spot, I feel like even though if you're just looking at what the change was and what the models say, you have to just look at what was the thing that gave you the biggest upside. And man, to have your season end with Aaron Rodgers on the sideline in that spot, if I'm a Packers fan, that is just such a tough, tough loss to handle.
Yeah, I felt like Matt LaFleur should have gone for it just so that Aaron Rodgers couldn't shade him for the rest of eternity. Just, you know, roll with it. Okay, a lot to unpack here. The reason why the models... So ESPN's model favored going for it. I want to say that. But it wasn't dramatic, which I think surprised people. And the reason why it wasn't dramatic, because if you kick the field goal and you sap the Bucs, you can then win the game, right? Whereas if you go for it, then you're tying the game. Potentially, if you get the 8 points, the Packers were down 8 points. And then you got to get another stop, yada, yada. Also, it's 4th and 8, which is very different from 4th and 2, 4th and 3, or whatever. I think that there was a lot playing into the decision. I think the fact that, so the Packers had the most, I think the best red zone offense, the second best to Tennessee in goal to go drives all season. A stat that blew my mind. So Rodgers was 17 for 19 targeting Davante Adams in the red zone all season. In this game, he was 1 for 6.
Oh my God. It felt like it too. Yeah.
I know. So I really think that kind of weighed in on it. Also, the fact that their tackles, and we'll talk about this in a second, were getting their asses kicked all game. You know, Rodgers said afterwards, as part of the aforementioned shade, well, I thought we might use all downs, but that didn't make sense, because if you thought you'd use all downs, you should have run for it. Even if you get caught, then you're in 4th and short. So I don't know if I buy that. I think you go for it because, you know, then even if you're stopped, you can still get the stop and try to tie it. And again, you have this incredible buzzsaw offense. But it's crazy. Like, we spent so much more energy talking about that decision, which I actually think was defensible. Like, Mike Pettine arguably lost him the game.
Oh, my gosh.
So that was the worst coaching decision. Forget McDermott, forget LaFleur, anything of the weekend. And from the Packers' perspective, we'll talk about the Bucs in a bit. Like, the fact that the Packers lost an offense, look, you lost the best left tackle in football. Last week, you didn't feel it because Aaron Donald was, you know, a shell of himself. You felt it against Tampa. It's fine. Like, I do think Green Bay probably should have run the ball more, and I have some quibbles with some of the decisions, and Rodgers made a few mistakes, but you're not that angry about that. The defense, which was the weakness of this team, arguably did enough, or Jair Alexander did enough, but your coach he screwed you. Mike Pettine, look, putting them in single high at the end of that half was indefensible. I am still, like, my mind is boggled by the fact that that happened, Sheil. Sorry.
I'm with you. I mean, I don't understand it. When I rewatched this game, I just thought, I actually thought Rodgers played better than I initially gave him credit for. And I thought that, like, everyone around him let him down in like a huge way, especially, and we'll talk about the Bucs, like you said, but when you compare it to sort of how Brady was getting helped by a lot of people around him. But the Mike Pettine thing, I don't understand how coaches are, you know, sleeping in their offices and never seeing their families. And like every waking hour where if you're not watching film, you're falling behind. And then like a situation like this, where, you know, a 12-year-old playing Madden or whatever can figure out what coverage to call. Single high man coverage. In that spot, there's insane. 6 seconds left. The Bucs said they were just basically going for a Hail Mary, and you're playing with a single high. And then I think the other guy was like a robber, which is generally, you know, he's going to take away routes in the middle of the field.
He was doing nothing. He was it was Savage, right? Who you're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Like, when you watch it, the all 22, it's like watching him, it's like you hear the Curb Your Enthusiasm music playing.
Yeah, I thought about that actually when I was watching. I mean, the same play, but they're in max protect. So Gronkowski and Fournette are in to block. Two Packers defenders who have them in man coverage are just standing there. You're just wasting them. They're literally doing nothing, standing there by the line of, at the line of scrimmage. Kevin King, who's having a nightmarish half, is one-on-one against Scotty Miller. I mean, you know, your coach costs you in a huge way. And it's like, I'm not going to say that the Packers would have won that game if they stopped them there, but it was such a huge sequence there from like 38 seconds left in the first half where you thought, the Packers might score here. They've got a first down to basically, you know, 2 minutes gone in the third quarter. I think it was like under 2 minutes on the game clock where the Buccaneers outscored them, you know, 14-0 or 18-0 or whatever it was. And I agree with you. That was like just the most mind-boggling play of the entire weekend.
Was that the Aikman game or was it Romo? Who's calling that game?
That was Aikman, I think.
That was Aikman.
Yeah, okay. Romo did the second one.
The only possible explanation is that Mike Pettine, much like Aikman, saw Scotty Miller and was like, oh, he's slow. Or didn't Aikman compare him to Julian Edelman? Not slow, but it's like, you know, it's quite obvious why. And that's the only possible explanation. I can think that maybe Mike Pettine had never seen Scotty Miller before or was unaware of his existence. I don't know. It's crazy. You said something that I want to hit on, which is that Rodgers played well. Rodgers played better than Brady, candidly. He just had a much more adverse situation. He was pressured on 40% of his dropbacks, which is a day at the office for like Deshaun Watson and Russell Wilson, but Rodgers was amongst the least pressured quarterbacks like Brady in football this year. The offensive line, it hit hard. It hit at the wrong time. I mean, the tackles were just getting absolutely brutalized all game, Billy Turner and Rick Wagner. And if I had one criticism of LaFleur, like I said, I do think that, you know, they were trying to move him around a little bit, but waited a long time to get help for Wagner on the right side. It was a nightmare. And it's just the contrast. You mentioned this between what he was dealing with and what Brady was dealing with it's dramatic. And so like, it's one of those games where I think Brady finished with a better QBR and I think on an EPA per play basis, because he had all those deep balls in the first half, you know, they both had interceptions, but Brady's were kind of more arm punty outcome wise. But watching it, when you consider the context, Brady just had it so much easier in this game.
Yeah, I mean, that really stood out to me. I mean, Rodgers, you know, I'm not going to rip Devontae Adams because, you know, he's been incredible all year and he's a great player and he's saved them. But, you know, he drops a touchdown. St. Brown drops a two-point conversion. The offensive tackles are getting smoked all game long. Mike Pettine calls this insane coverage at the end of the first half. Matt LaFleur turtles up with the game on the line. Like, I'm just making notes of all this and going, like, what were they doing? Oh, my gosh, what were they doing to him? And so, it really felt like a scenario where if a few, you know, three plays offensively, like went a different way for Rodgers, his numbers would have looked a lot different. Even the interception he threw, I mean, I'll give Murphy Bunting made a fantastic play there. But, you know, you could certainly make a case that Lazard kind of, if he can fight him off and at least force an incompletion, there was a, I think another third down where Lazard wanted a flag. But he had a chance to make the reception there. And so there were all these different things, I feel like, that did not go Rodgers' way, which I don't know, maybe that was why he was in his feelings or getting emotional after the game and setting the internet on fire with some of his comments. But yeah, I did not think that he played a bad game given all those circumstances.
The future is a beautiful mystery. phrasing.
I love him. He's here to give us content.
You really
Thank
is.
You, Aaron. We
and then today he was like, who, you know, the hot dog meme from I Think You Should Leave, that we're all trying to find the guy who did this. I feel like that was Rodgers today on the Pat McAfee show being like, I don't know why this is a talking point. It must be so weak. It's like, dog. The Brady interceptions, one was the first one to Evans was high, his fault. Mike Evans is like 20 feet tall and that was like 25 feet. The second one was the Adrian Amos.
Yes.
That was, I'd say, on Brady. It wasn't as egregious, but he did throw into double coverage downfield and he wasn't really under pressure. And then the third one wasn't his fault at all. That was where I think it was Fournette failed to do anything, really. But for the most part, you know, Brady was really good in the first half, like threw some just absolutely gorgeous pearls. And then in the second half, the Bucs defense, people got mad at me for saying this yesterday. The Bucs defense won them the game in the second half. They were really good. So, I mean, that's kind of the team, right? Like, they're crazy. I don't know. They make big plays. They make like, the Bucs are not consistent on a down-to-down or drive-to-drive basis, but Brady will throw two pearls on third down, and Shaq and JPP will force two interceptions, and then that's ball game.
Yes, they're, you know, I think Football Outsiders has them as the most high variance team, and it's felt like that all season long. And their defense in high leverage moments was incredible in this game. I mean, JPP and Shaq Barrett were fantastic, right? They have all their sacks, I think, came without blitzing, by the way. So that, you know, when we're spinning this ahead to the Chiefs, I thought that was pretty interesting that all their sacks came on four-man rushes. I thought that Jordan Whitehead play was like one of my favorite plays of the weekend, where he just came down, fired downhill and forced the Aaron Jones fumble at the start of the third quarter. That was an incredible play because that's third down. Devin White got lost in coverage and Whitehead just read it and like laid the wood and turnover, touchdown. And all of a sudden it felt like the game was getting out of hand. So that, we mentioned the Murphy Bunting interception. And so they had guys who just came up time after time. Todd Bowles, I thought, called a fantastic game where they were doubling Devontae Adams a lot on third down or in high leverage situations. And I feel like I've said high leverage 75 times during this podcast. I'm not.
Everything's high leverage.
I'm not winning a bet there, but Bowles was great. And so, and even offensively, you know, that Chris Godwin 52-yard catch where he just like out-muscles Savage, that was a big play. That was a third down where if they have to punt there, then the Packers are getting the ball back and they scheme stuff up, you know, the screen to Gronkowski, the screen to Godwin. And so I just thought they did a lot of good things. And obviously Brady, you know, aside from those interceptions, certainly played well also.
Yeah, the screen to Gronk was a truly sick play, too, where they confused them with it was like a jet sweep. I can't remember, was it Godwin or Brown? Or Brown didn't play, so I guess it was Godwin. Yeah, they had them fooled. And then, Gronk, good things happened, man, in the playoffs with Gronk. And then the Godwin catch is a good example of why you shouldn't just compare quarterbacks with EPA per play.
Right.
It's not a good throw. Whitehead's a name to keep an eye on. So he went out of the game, hurt his shoulder, I believe, in his day-to-day. And of course, I think Antoine Winfield will come back. It's all the more impressive that they did this with backup safeties in the game. But you made a point, and this is something that really jumped out on my rewatch, and something that I think as we start looking to the Super Bowl is going to be impactful, which is, of course, the four-man rush. You know, JPP and
Shaq Barrett.
Shaq Barrett feasting on the outsides, but Rodgers could not step up in the pocket because Sue, Vea, and Steve McClendon, too, were just plugging that thing up. Vea, like, he's clearly not 100%, but find you a 350-pound man who can break his ankle and come back and look like that. I mean, good heavens. And that's, of course, going to be just so important. The ability to get a four-man rush. Actually, ESPN's pass rush win rate has their two best games with a standard pass rush of the season, Tampa Bay. It's the last two games they've played. So picking at the right time, if you will. And obviously that's going to be really, really important against Patrick Mahomes. So yeah, I don't know. I'm like early on, I'm leaning Chiefs still, but the Bucs really impressed me in this game, particularly the defense. And they're going to need every bit of that in this game, but I'm pretty excited. So yeah, so let's wrap up again with the losing team, Green Bay. Despite all the beautiful mystery and uncertainty, I'm pretty sure Aaron Rodgers is going to be a Green Bay Packer next year. What do you think, like, what should be the focus of their offseason?
I mean, I guess they have to decide on Mike Pettine. You know, I don't know. I know this was a conversation last offseason after they lost to the 49ers. They were able to produce three interceptions here in the second half, so they kept the team in it. And certainly you're not going to get rid of a guy because of one call, or at least I wouldn't think you would. But I mean, they weren't a great defense, you know, the regular season. They were what, mediocre to below average by every statistical metric. And I kind of like their talent. You know, I think they've added players. They've got a great corner in Alexander. They've got a pass rusher in Za'Darius Smith, who's really good. They've got good safeties. And so it's always felt to me like they haven't maximized their talent on that side of the ball. So I don't know if that's making schematic changes, you know, maybe some tweaks personnel wise or what, but I do think they have to certainly figure that out. And offensively, I mean, if you can add, I feel like the Chiefs show us that when you can add weapons, just add weapons. Don't worry. It'll pay off in the long run when, like, Mecole Hardman, no one can catch him on a 50-yard run or whatever it was. Like, don't worry. Just keep adding players. So I think they should continue to do that. They've got to get running back figured out. I guess Aaron Jones is a free agent and their offensive line. But, I mean, they've been so good. When you come off a season where you've had the most efficient offense in the NFL, like, you have figured out the hardest part about, you know, building a team with sustained success. So they've got that figured out. Rodgers was incredible. He was good in that scheme. And so, I mean, they've been what, 26-6 the last two regular seasons.
Really,
so,
yeah.
You know, it's kind of just like, you know, I feel like if they played this game 10 times, they win at least half of them. I thought this was a game where some things didn't go their way. That's not going to make them feel better, but that's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah, I mean, if David Bakhtiari plays, they probably win.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, you know, guess what? Losing the best left tackle in the NFL hurts you in the playoffs. It's shocking, I know. So, yeah, I agree with you. It's all about defense for me. You know, probably Kevin King will probably walk, so they're going to maybe look to upgrade their linebacker coaching, I think, and then just continuing to add weapons. So, chin up, Packers fans. I don't think Aaron's going anywhere. As always, let's wrap up with a few questions for our guest.
And now it's time for Dinks and Dunks. I'm getting paid for this, right?
Dinks and Dunks is presented by DraftKings, America's top-rated daily fantasy app. Download the DraftKings app today and use code MENA to get in on all of the action. Sheil, I can't let you go without asking you first about the team that you cover, Philadelphia. Do you think, this is one of my five questions, or four, because Lenny gets the fifth one. Do you think Jalen Hurts will actually get a shot at starting next year?
Man, I have. I wish I had a strong take here. I have no idea. Doesn't lend itself to very good.
Should he get a shot? Let me rephrase that.
He should get a shot. Yeah. I mean, if they're sticking with Wentz and Hurts, I don't see how you just hand the job over to Wentz, given how last season played out. And so I think it's going to be a big test for the first time head coach, Nick Sirianni. Right away, he's going to be asked about it. And it's like, are you going to say Wentz is my guy? Are you going to say the best player will play? Are they going to trade Wentz? Are they going to draft a quarterback? It's like everything is in play. But I would strongly disagree with them just saying, let's make this offseason all about getting Wentz back on track, handing him the keys and making this his team, because I don't think that would sit well in the locker room. And I don't think that would be fair to the players.
He should just say it's a beautiful mystery. That seems to be the go-to avoidance answer these days. For my second question, let's stay in the division. What would you do, assuming you can't get Stafford, what would you do if you're Washington?
If I'm Washington, who would I go after? I would take a shot on another quarterback. I'm trying to think of which quarterback. We're assuming Watson is staying put. That's the obvious answer. I don't know. I would take a shot on maybe a Sam Darnold. I could see, you see how he looks for a year and then make a longer term decision. I think if they're not going to get the home run guy, then they've got to take a bunch of swings. So, Cam Newton's got to land somewhere. I don't know if Ron Rivera and Scott Turner want to reunite with Cam Newton, but I think if I were them, I would take a bunch of swings. So I would get Darnold or Cam or somebody like that, and then also draft somebody and hope that one of these options pans out.
I like that. Darnold is an interesting fit there. All right, question three. Which of the playoff teams do you think is most likely to take a step backwards next year?
I'm trying to remember all the playoff teams. Let's see. Okay. It's not the Bills, I wouldn't say, not the Ravens, not the Browns, Titans, Colts. This is great pod. This is great for your audience here.
This is random. I'm hitting you out of nowhere.
How about the Bears? I mean, I don't know how big of a, that's not a good answer. Let me take it back.
That's a good answer.
How about the New Orleans Saints?
That's the correct answer. Yeah, obviously. Yeah, I didn't.
They've got to get rid of half their roster because of their cap situation, and that we don't know what they're doing at quarterback. So the New Orleans Saints.
That's a good one. It's going to be like the garage sale over there. Okay, I can't let you go without getting a Super Bowl prediction. Score and winner, please.
Oh my gosh! Already.
I know. Really, you don't have to stand by it.
All right.
I'm going to change mine 100 times.
I'm going to go with the Chiefs. I think the line is 3. My initial reaction is to say that they're going to cover, and so I will say Chiefs 31, Tampa 27.
I feel like I gave that exact score earlier today.
It's so lame with the common numbers. I should have gone 35 to 26 or something. But
I feel like that's going to widen between now and the Super Bowl. 3 seems tight. Interesting. All right. So last question as always is from Lenny, my co-host. Sheil, Lenny knows that you started covering the Seahawks in 2015. Is that right? That's what Lenny says.
2015. That's correct. Yeah.
He wants to know if you accept responsibility for ruining the team.
Well, people think I was there when they got to the Super Bowl, but I joined after they got. So I got there when it was just full drama mode. But I will accept responsibility. Yeah, they haven't won a lot of playoff games since I left. So hopefully when I, try to get in touch with people over there, they'll show me the proper respect and know the kind of power that I actually have.